Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, and I've still got my 100-day cough. I think I'm up to day 70, and I probably sound worse than I feel. But we've got another special guest lined up for you, and this is going to be a real humdinger because he's talking about events in sport and how we work out whether they actually do make money or not, and that is TJ Rosendyke. My name's Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, good to be back.
Yes, you've been travelling again?
Oh, quick trip to Slovenia, as you do.
just on my days off.
No, well, we got invited there for the documentary. It was in the Sports Film Festival there, and it was a really good event, actually. I really enjoyed it. I think I was saying to you, they had this wonderful event in parallel to the film festival where they took some of the films into the schools. But then they had a mini Olympics where they got all the children sort of to be out in the playground. One of the school kids ran in with an Olympic torch. They had some Olympians there who then told their stories to the kids to inspire them. And then for the rest of the day, the kids got the chance to try all these Olympic sports. And I just thought it was brilliant. I mean, the enthusiasm, the energy, it was just really, really inspiring.
Now, I believe you picked up another giant novelty check while you were over there, didn't you? Oh,
there was no novelty check. We just got a nice piece of glassware.
Oh, good. Rogaška, on the mantle?
Rogaška glass, which is, you know, one of the top glass manufacturers in Europe. Yeah, it's a very nice one, and it'll be with the others.
Well done, mate. Well done.
So who's starting?
Well, I think today we should start off with the World Cup. Apparently, allegedly, the largest sporting event in the world. Some other people knocking on the door of that one, but we'll leave them for later for the interview. But what do you make of it? We had the final just a couple of days ago, Spain. I think when you look back over the tournament and you look at some of the stats involved, probably the team that deserved to win. I mean, they conceded one goal across the whole tournament. That's a pretty phenomenal effort.
I think Spain definitely deserved to win. I don't think there's any argument there. Argentina's behaviour during the final, and I'm not, having grown up in England, I'm not saying, hey, I thought Argentina deserved to win their semi-final against England. But their behaviour in the final was just truly atrocious after the final whistle, and then also turning their backs on the Spanish when they're receiving their medals. It was a very, very sad day for football, in my opinion. And I think the World Cup, despite what Johnny Infantino, as President Trump likes to call him, may think, I don't think it was the best World Cup ever. I think some of the football was. I was amazed at how attacking a lot of the teams were. I think the goalkeeping, a lot of the goalkeepers made some spectacular saves. But I do think goalkeeping standards have dropped now because of the balls, in that you're not seeing goalkeepers trying to catch the ball. They're just trying to fist it away. And we saw a lot of times where they fisted it straight to the forward, who then buried it in the back of the net. Equally, I don't know where this... I do know where it's come from, Manuel Neuer, where the goalkeepers are coming out and twisting sideways. And if you noticed, and hopefully goalkeeping coaches have noticed, that the players now are hitting the ball pretty much straight at them when they're coming out because they know they're going to twist. So they're hitting it where they know there's going to be space. So whereas before, you know, a goalkeeper would come out and try and make himself big and smother the attack, you're not seeing that now. And I think there were a lot of goals came because of that change in technique and the players have become savvy to it and therefore found it easier to beat them. But I thought overall, and I watched, I think, I didn't watch all of the games in their entirety, I've got to be honest. I watched the extended highlights of quite a lot, but I think there were only about six or seven games I didn't watch, the highlights or the full game.
That's a pretty good effort, just quietly.
Yeah, well, it was...
It's a long tournament.
It was, and it was, but there were some cracking games, and it was, you know, the African nations. I'm going to write a piece about this because, do you know that, John, there were over 300 players of African descent playing for other countries.
Wow. Wow, yeah. Including for our nation.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at Africa in sport, if, my God, how good could they be if all these players that were of African descent were playing for their home nations?
And I think in some ways the old narrative of that was European clubs sending agents down there and picking these kids up before they'd become old enough to really be a part of that nation's footballing setup. Whereas now what we're getting is immigrant
refugee
types who are growing up essentially in that country. So the dynamic of how they're getting to these levels.
Yeah, or even the children of refugees.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you looked at Elise of France, I think is, I forget which part of Africa one of his parents comes from. The other is French, but he was born in England and then moved, you know, to France and plays for France. But yeah, look, it's becoming an international, players are more international, cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
Before they choose. And they have, some of them have, you know, three options as to which country they want to play for. But I just sort of, I think I've always had a soft spot for Africa. And I forget who it was who said, I think it might have been Pele, was, you know, by the year 2000, an African nation will win the World Cup. Hasn't happened yet. And it was interesting to see.
But African players have won World Cups.
Oh, yes, exactly. And it was interesting because there was a real feeling, you know, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories in this World Cup. And I know that, okay, Egypt and Morocco progressed further into the tournament, but the rest of Africa felt, again, that, hang on a sec, Black Africa was plotted against to make sure they were eliminated.
Oh, there's a lot of conspiracy theories flying around this world. And you know what? Some of them weren't even conspiracy theories, Ashley. Red card. Like, what was that all about? Just pure graft and corruption.
Yeah, but if FIFA made a rod from their own back because they reduced the penalty from Ronaldo so that he could play the first two games of the World Cup. Now, the rest of the football world, I blame them because they are all members of FIFA. They all have a vote and they should have said, no, this is unacceptable. This cannot happen. We will not take the field of play if he walks out there. And you just got to take a stand against this because what you've done is the moral fabric of the sport now has been tarnished forever. Because how do you come back from these things?
And of course, you had the wonderfully ironic scenes at the end of the tournament where the captain of SS Self-Insertion placed himself in front of the one team he probably didn't want to win the tournament. After all the crap he said about Spain, to stand there and hog the limelight from those players, that was just priceless. Well,
that just sums him up, doesn't it, really?
Well, in some ways it sums up the whole tournament.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very interesting because the pressure now on Infantino and the rumoured belief that UEFA is going to take a stand against FIFA. Idiot. I actually hope this all happens. Because I think the structure of the sport has to change. And we thought it was going to change when Blatter and all the cronies beneath him were arrested and left the sport. But it hasn't changed. It's just all gone a little bit quieter. And it's not quite as obvious. But there's still a lot of bad things going on in FIFA and in football. And hopefully, what we've seen now, people that truly care about the game can now make a difference.
Now, the one thing that I think has come out of that tournament is the general global distrust, almost hatred of the VAR.
Oh, that, to me, if I was Infantino after that tournament, I would get rid of it. But my belief, and you know we've had lots of conversations about this, I said VAR has been brought in to get the results they want. And in this tournament, if you want my perspective of it, I believe that happened in a lot of games, that VAR was used to get the outcome that FIFA, or maybe not FIFA, the tournament organisers, whatever. I thought that happened as well in the Women's World Cup here in Australia. I think the same thing happened in both those tournaments, and it needs seriously looking at.
And something I've often said is that the margins for error in VAR are so minute that they're beyond the capacity of humans to react to, in the sense that, like, you when you see a fingernail across the line, and they or a
did that really or, influence play?
Yeah, I mean,
that's my question. Yeah. Does a toe influence play? Not really. And let's not forget why this was brought in. It was brought in to make sure that there were no howlers.
Oh,
that was what it was all about.
The cricket argument. It's like, and the, all we spend our time on now is not on howlers. They're on things that are so minutely imperceptible to a human eye.
But, I mean, we had again the Egypt goal against Argentina that was disallowed. You know, we went back 38 seconds, I think it was, in their attack to the other end of the pitch. If that's not been picked up by the referee and it's been regarded as inconsequential, play on.
So that's a really interesting one. So the ref's out there, the play happens, and ref goes, yep, play on. And the ball goes to the other end and they score, right?
Yep.
And then they go, oh no, we're going to roll it back. How far back do we need to roll it to find an infringement that we can cancel the goal with?
Well, the player's in the tunnel. You know, maybe he pinched the player in the tunnel.
So is this on every goal? Do they roll back 40 seconds or 50 seconds or a minute on every single goal to figure out whether within the time frame they're allowing there was an infringement that the umpire missed?
That's what we're led to believe. Look, to me, I think all you really need to look at is the goal, and the final play really is, you know, we had Thierry Henry punch the ball in against Ireland, which is always remembered. You know, you've got Frank Lampard's
hand of God.
You have hand of God, Frank Lampard's goal for England against Germany that didn't count. Even England's goal against Germany in 66. You know, to me, those are the moments you need to look at and try and work out. Did the ball cross the line? Was it a hand? That's all. Forget the rest. Because what you're doing as well is you're killing those moments where fans are ecstatic. They think they've scored. And then you're just bringing them down. And we see it in hockey as well. It's the same thing, you know?
Like if we as spectators knew what the parameters were, but we don't. So,
well, it seems to
did
vary.
Did they go back 38 seconds on every goal? How far do you go back? You know,
but this is the thing. There's no clarity. Now, I was talking to someone on the weekend about this, and that's what I like about rugby union. So rugby union, when there is they bring in the video umpire or video referee in rugby, the referee on the pitch will stand with the two assistants. They'll watch the replay on the big screen, so there's no hidden cameras or anything. It's all there for everybody inside the stadium who's paid to go, so deserve to be given the information that the referee is basing their decision on. And then when they've all discussed it with the video umpire, he goes, so are we all in agreement that was a hand that was used, so the goal should be rubbed out, and we start with a goal kick. And everyone goes, yes, yes, yes. So you go, fantastic, we've got it, understand it. And I think they do it really, really well because there's a discussion, it's open, the vision is there. Other sports need to have the same transparency.
Yep, I would agree with that. But, you know, it's over for another 4 years. And they don't need to make the tournament bigger to allow more teams to compete because every team in the world currently competes.
Well, more than countries in the world because there are more countries in FIFA than the UN. But, yes, all the qualifying is part of the World Cup.
That's
and
right.
All it is to qualify to play in the finals of the World Cup.
And, honestly, it's too long.
Oh, it was too long.
It's far too long. And
you've got teams, sadly, that were there that shouldn't be there, that they weren't that good.
Well, say for like us here in Australia, we're out before by the halfway part of the tournament. And that was still 4 weeks in. So people will lose interest real quick.
Well, Australia, once they were out, you didn't see much about it over here, did you?
Oh, no, unless you're watching SBS, you basically wouldn't have known it was on.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Marco Bresciano, and you are listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a guest I've been trying to get on for a long time because I had a conversation with him at a film festival and thought straight away, here is a man that's going to back up what John and I have been talking about for a long time. How the heck do these people claim sporting events make so much money? What is the formula? How does it work? Well, our special guest today, TJ Rosendyke, is going to share his information because he's been working in sport for over 50 years and he has all the answers.
TJ Rosendyke, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
My pleasure.
Well, I've been wanting to chat to you for a while, but before we talk about the sort of finances of major sporting events, I was looking at, obviously, your dad was involved in sport over there in the US. Were you given really no choice but to follow in his footsteps, because he was heavily involved?
Yeah. Actually, he did his entire career in sport in one way or another, going all the way back to the early 50s. He was the all-service coach for the U.S. military and, in fact, brought some athletes to the 56 Melbourne Olympics. So he was no stranger to the land down under. He had a number of track and field. That was his sport, was track and field. So he had world record holders in his stable and was eventually inducted into the Track and Field Hall of Fame in this country. But he went on to work extensively through Southeast Asia and was the national coach for Indonesia in the early 60s, back in the good old days of Sukarno and the non-aligned movement and all the rest of that. But in so doing, he became exposed to what coaching practices were in Eastern Europe. At that time, the Eastern Bloc countries had done a better job of applying scientific principles to the art of coaching. In the U.S., it was still primarily a guild system where you hooked up with a good coach and he would bring you along and so on and so forth. But he took away some very important lessons from that that he went on to apply in the United States. If you know anything about history of sport in the United States, basically, say on the international level with the Olympics, from the 1904 St. Louis Olympics onward, the United States had racked up the most medals on the cumulative medal table. And by the way, the reason we got the jump in 1904 is because a lot of European countries didn't want to travel 4,000 miles across the Atlantic and then another 1,000 miles on a train. So they said, let's just bag this thing and move on. But up until 1972 was a real eye-opener for the U.S. The Russians beat the Americans in basketball for the first time ever. And that's because they didn't understand, the coaches didn't understand international rules, which were different than the NBA and collegiate in this country. They had the U.S. track coach didn't know how to read a 24-hour clock.
Wow.
you know, so basically the starting time for the 100-meter final was expressed in like something like 1,700 hours. And so he didn't show up on time. And his athletes arrived in the stadium just in time to see the gold medal hung around the neck of Valerie Borzov. At that time, he's Ukrainian, but he was running for Russia. So all of that really underscored that sport in the U.S. had gone off the rails. From that was the Presidential Commission on Amateur Sport, which examined the structure of amateur and international sport in the United States. Long story short, that culminated in the Amateur Sports Act in 1978, which established the framework for how we did sports. But the point that I really want to make on this was sport education, that it really drove home the point that the American teams were lagging in terms of professionalism in the training that they were receiving and what have you. Concurrently, there was a rather seminal study done called the Blythe-Mueller Report that looked at the correlation between the degree and or the number and degree of severity of injuries in athletes and the professional preparation of coaches. And they found a real correlation there. What a surprise. The bottom line is that untrained coaches hurt their athletes. So looking at all of that, my father founded the United States Sports Academy in 1972. And from there, it was initially a graduate school only, master's and above. But it is and remains the only freestanding accredited sport university in the United States. Along the way, it got a new name, the United States Sports University, USSU. And so I went to work in the school, working part-time for a long time, but in a full-time capacity in 1982. And then I worked 47 years in the academy, did every job in the place. And I did not walk into the C-suite. I got promoted to the mailroom. But eventually worked my way up to where I spent the last 7 years at the institution as the president and CEO. So.
Yeah. When I was reading up, I saw that you'd actually been in so many different roles. So I suppose it gives you a very good overall perspective of sport.
Yes. Well, I was also extensively involved in our international programs. For better or for worse, around the world, the United States is perceived to be preeminent in sport, both on the basis of performance, when you look at the number of medals in the international competition, whether at the continental level at the Pan Am or the global level with the Olympic movement, and certainly in selected sports. I'll exclude football from that list, as we saw in the World Cup. But also by the sheer size of the sport industry in this country. I don't know if you saw some of the reels and video clips, Instagram and what have you, posted on social media about the experience of people from around the world, including Australians, who saw American sport infrastructure for the first time. These magnificent billion-dollar facilities that are air conditioned, by the way.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
but the economic turnover for sport in the United States, where people have to buy a ticket to get in to see the event, depending on what you toss in the pot, is north of $280 billion a year. And
is that across all sports?
Yeah, that's across all sports. And if you were to include recreational sports that people just do on their own, like, for example, tomorrow I'll be playing in a golf tournament. I'm going to provide the comic relief, I think. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, that local municipal tournament would not be included in that number. But if you were to include that stuff it would probably climb to about 350 billion and would include employment levels on the order of about 8 million people.
Wow.
So if you look simply at the size of the sport industry and the impact that it has in this country, combined with performance outcomes, that's why the United States does have that perception around the world. But as a result of that, we had countries of all types beating a path to our door, you know, to do joint programs and what have you. And so the institution has delivered sport education, service, and training programs around the world in some 67 countries at last count. And that has ranged from the full service conduct of the entire national sport effort. For example, in the Kingdom of Bahrain, when we started there and signed a contract there in 1976, we brought to the Arabian Gulf region, I won't call it the Persian Gulf, but for obvious reasons, but the first human performance lab, the first true sport medicine center, the first comprehensive strength and conditioning center. We provided national coaches for a whole range of sports, you know, track and field, swimming, tennis, what have you. And we did that basically for quite a long period of time. And eventually the program was nationalized. But we continue to work there even to this day. The King of Bahrain, His Majesty King Hamad Al Khalifa, appointed me to the board of directors of their General Sport Authority, which is the CSO, the Central Sport Organization for the country, that oversees all of the sport activities and its affiliates, like the Olympic Committee and the sport associations and developmental programs and what have you. So, and I was recently, actually a year ago, appointed to another 4-year term. So from 1977 to this day, we're still working in Bahrain, but I spent 9 years. Maybe someone thinks I am, I don't have to be put totally out to pasture just yet. I spent 9 years in Saudi Arabia and helped to organize programs, probably on 3 different continents, Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America, here in the U.S. How could I forget that? But anyway, so yeah, I had a fairly extensive background in international sport, which sort of has given me a rather unique perspective, because Americans do tend to be a little ethnocentric, to say the least.
Well, one of the things,
that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, when we met, one of the things we were talking about was, and you've obviously seen it around the world now, is how we're promised, if you host this event, it's going to make you X amount of money. Now, is there a formula that they base these projections on, or is it, let's pluck a number and throw that out there?
Yeah. Let me, if I can, I'll digress a little bit on that and how some of these things come to be. And in this country, most of the municipalities have something called a sport commission or sport authority. And it may be a part of a visitors convention and visitors bureau, something of that nature. And their whole thing is to attract visitors, groups, you know, conventions, as the name would suggest, to the city, because they see economic benefit that's derived from those activities. And it's the same thing with sport commissions. except they focus narrowly on sport rather than the dog breeders of America, you yeah. know, as a different kind of a convention over there. But in so doing, you got to provide seed money. Most events require a money up front to organize a bid and get it submitted in the format that the sport association or group is seeking, or a bond has to be posted, or a fee. Some of them actually charge, you want our business? Here's the money that we need to make it happen. So when they are confronted with that, most of these organizations have bosses too, you know, and they want to say, all right, so if we pony up the cash, what are we going to get from it?
Yeah.
Well, the thing that is most commonly bandied about is economic impact. That for every dollar spent, the city or whatever entity will derive three or six times that amount coming back. And so they're the most common ones that I heard. You know, I worked in the Mobile Sport Commission for a while. In fact, it eventually got disbanded because they weren't doing the job properly. And then it came back again as the Mobile Sport Commissioner Authority. And they're still about, well, I was on the steering committee for that because of the background that I had. But I would listen to the presentation on, yeah, we can bring the American Senior Softball Championships to Mobile. The estimated number of athletes is X. The number of room nights will be Y. The tax, room tax derived will be Z, and so on. But a lot of those, it seemed that you were right, that the numbers were sort of pulled out of the air. And I really sort of proved that for one event. The Mobile has some beautiful golf courses. And one of them attracted the Lady PGA, the LPGA event as on the tour. And so they were saying, yeah, this is going to bring, you know, you got to pay for that, by the way. This will bring X number of spectators for the event to town and whatever. So they had some fairly spectacular numbers that were laid out on the table. But because access to the course was limited, the parking was offsite and they ran shuttle buses for everybody to get them to the venue.
Of course, yeah.
Right. So what I did was I was teaching a sport finance course at the graduate level at the time, among some of the other weird things that I have done. But I had the students write a survey that would be applied on trying to gauge what was the true economic impact. Simple stuff like, where are you from? When did you get here? How many nights were you here? Did you arrive early? Are you going to stay late? Are you going to do any other attractions? Yada, yada. It was, it was short and sweet because you had a captive audience. So every time the shuttle bus loaded up, a couple of my students would get on and work the bus collecting data on where they came from. And lo and behold, we found that there were not a lot of folks that came from out of town. And once we reduced the data on that, it became abundantly clear that the economic impact had been significantly overstated. And I'll just simply summarize by saying that subsequently cooled the ardor of the sport commission on bringing them back. So Anyway, in a nutshell, that's how some of those things work.
So it would
But,
appear. Sorry, yeah, you go, you go.
well, the other thing that I was going to mention, that there are other measures of economic impact, for example, employment multipliers. If I build this facility, what kind of numbers will be generated from employing people to operate there? So let's take a look, for instance, at the Superdome in New Orleans, which was the largest indoor sport venue. It was built in the 19 late 60s, and it had a not a suspended roof or retractable, but a concrete roof, you know. So it has seating for about 80,000 people. But it was also designed as a multi-purpose facility. And so when we talk about a standard rule of thumb, if a group, say a professional team or some other enterprise entity, is pitching a public-private entity, you know, partnership, a PPP, to build a sport facility, and a lot of these days are in the billion-dollar range. What is going to be the economic impact? What is the money going to be generated out of that facility? So if we look at the Superdome, it was designed so there would be collegiate football on Saturday, either Louisiana State or Tulane University, which, by the way, university sport is huge in this country, and we can talk about that if you wish. Followed by the New Orleans Saints professional NFL professional football, American football team on Sunday, followed by the Gulf Coast Boat Show on Monday. And on Thursday came the flower show or whatever. But the supposition on that was that you generally had to have about 330 nights or days a year booking activities to generate the rental fees and all of that to cover the operating costs. So I know in Europe you get a lot of standalone stadiums where the only thing they do is soccer style football. I'm in the States. I got to sometimes
That's okay. We
distinguish.
understand.
Yeah, but anyway, but they don't generally get anywhere near the same usage that the facilities in the US get. Indoor venues are booked extensively for everything from concerts to, like I said, the boat show, professional sports of various stripes, you know, to make it economically feasible.
But if you're having to pay for those events as well to win those events, then those margins again are going further and further out. So you've actually got to get more. So it's a really vicious circle, really.
Well, in a way, you have to walk into these things eyes wide open. If I'm approaching the city or the state, which, by the way, got so out of control in the US that laws were passed at the federal level on tax breaks for developers, you know, because that was always factored into the equation that the cost for building this is tax deductible from the federal level on this enterprise or what have you. And finally, the federal government has said, stepped in and says, we're not doing that anymore. So that sort of changed the equation on underlying financing. A lot of people are also questioning how we're still doing that. In fact, I read a side article, you know, surrounding the World Cup within the last 10 days, where people were saying, wait a minute here. We're talking about helping to underwrite a $1 billion facility being built at the behest of a billionaire to host or to field his team of millionaires, you know, for which I'm going to have to pay $100 for decent seats in the venue to see the event. So what's wrong with this picture? Kind of a thing. And so it has become a little more difficult for people to go ahead and put, you know, these kinds of projects together. And the old supposition that you would have a facility for 50 years, and in the case of the Superdome in New Orleans, we're well past that, you know, anticipated 50-year mark. But now you'll have huge stadiums that are basically being torn down after 25 or 30 years because they're not keeping pace with the required amenities. You know, with some of these venues, I can get in my seat and have concierge service and have a steak dinner delivered to me while watching a football game inside the stadium. With AI applications, built-in video, you know, in the seats and all the rest of that, the turnover in these massive facilities is becoming more and more frequent, and people are beginning to question, what are we doing with some of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so it sounds like there is really no metric to measure, you know, how things are, how much money is spent. So, I mean, how do these governments or associations get away with it?
Well, like I said, a lot of it is really unique to the municipality where it is going to be erected. And there's so many different considerations that wind up going into it. And that's one of the reasons why when I was teaching sport finance, it was a graduate level course. And among the different things that we had talked about were funding mechanisms, you know, considerations that go into all of those things. And these days, for example, bidding the Olympics, in Los Angeles, they have had an organizing committee at work there now for the better part of 6 years. And they got 2 more years to run before the games actually take place. It is a very large effort. There's so many different moving pieces that you do need to have professionally trained people to deal with all of that. My little alarm is feeling left out. So, but anyway, now she's looking at you. So go on.
That's all right.
But the upshot is that you do have to have people that are professionally trained and have the background in that to really put together a viable project.
But I mean, when we spoke, you were saying, you know, Paris initially had said it was going to generate all this money, but a lot of people in Europe only came in on the train for the day. They didn't stay in the top hotels because they were trying to gouge the prices and stayed at Airbnbs or with friends. So the projected figures for Paris are actually probably going to be way above what they actually generated.
Yes, actually, and that is one of the wraps on what we call SMEs. Super massive events, which would include, you know, the Olympic Games as a case in point, or the World Cup, or what have you. There's a tendency for people to strangle the golden goose, I guess, what have you. You know, hoteliers jump the rates. We saw that a lot of people were upset here in the United States about what happened with hotel room rates for the World Cup, and you had people from Europe arriving. And so it's not just the cost of the ticket, which was fairly high to get in to see, you know, the match, but here's the package of the hotel room, transport to the venue inside the city, let alone getting to the city, hotel rooms, all of that. And the prices for some of those, like, I'm going to go travel to Houston or Boston for the football match. You're going to spend a couple $1,000s just to get yourself there and into the match and then out again. So a lot of times when the local beneficiaries of those things, when they try to gouge the public or boost the rates, they wind up shooting themselves in the foot. I mentioned Los Angeles. Already, organizations there, labor unions and what have you, demanded a Olympic wage. In other words, the minimum wage for people in the entertainment industry, hospitality, all the way down to baggage porters in the airport, were demanding, you know, something like $35 an hour minimum, you know, during the Olympic period. And the LA Olympic Organizing Committee is saying, hey, wait a minute, this was not a part of the operating budget. And so who's going to pay the freight on that? Well, then the city is looking for guarantees from the organizing committee that our out-of-pocket costs, where we got to pay the airport baggage handlers or whatever, are going to be covered on this. So, and then demands that had absolutely nothing to do with the Olympics. Like one of the unions said that if we don't have in the contracts for the Olympic period, that there will not be any immigration customs enforcement agents at the venues. In other words, ICE agents are not allowed to be anywhere near the venues. We'll go on strike if we see them. What? Wow. Yeah. You're talking federal law enforcement. And so how can you as a union make a demand on federal law enforcement? So when we talk about all of the ancillary activities that surround the SMEs, it's very easy to see how things get out of hand. Atlanta, the 1996, and by the way, that's when we were talking about economic impact, where you were saying where Paris had a huge loss, I could say Sochi had a huge loss, the Athens games all but bankrupted the Greeks.
Yeah.
That one of the things that is also marketed to the powers that be is what's the term? I just had it. A perceived benefit. For example, Atlanta said that hosting the Olympics will boost Atlanta from a regional city to a global city. Psychic income is what they call it.
Right. Okay. That sounds good.
In other words, you got to have a crystal ball to actually see where that came in. But in a way, when you drive on the interstate highway into Georgia, the state or province that wherein lies Atlanta, when you hit the state line, it still says hosts of the 1996 Summer Olympic Games, and their logo is still on the sign. And you get to the Atlanta city limits and host of the 1996. So this is what I'm talking about, psychic income.
Yeah.
But Los Angeles, they turned a profit in 1984. And in fact, in some ways, I would say that the Los Angeles Olympics saved the Olympic movement. After the boycott games that occurred with Montreal and then Moscow and all the rest of them, that the boycott era, as they call it, they saw what happened with Montreal, who finally finished paying the bill for that only a few years ago.
It makes one wonder why you would actually host it. I mean, TJ, we're running out of time. It's been great. I could talk to you for a lot, lot longer, but I think we're going to have to catch up again and continue this conversation.
Yeah, sure. Well, anyway, the point that I want to make is that most of the Olympic venue or cities do wind up with a financial loss. Los Angeles made money. Atlanta broke even, at least before the lawsuits were settled. But they were roundly criticized for being too commercialized. But Atlanta had to become very commercialized because they didn't have the government support. The federal government provided security and certain infrastructure things, but they were not at all involved in underwriting the actual competition itself. So how the organizing committees handle the run-up to the games and what happens afterwards really determines how it's going to wind up doing.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was TJ Rozandyk, and I'm... I think I said he'd been in sport over 50 years. Well, he worked for 47 years.
Go through that CV. You don't even have to read all of it out. Just read half of it.
You want me to read some of it?
Read some of it.
Okay, so TJ is president and a professor emeritus of the United States Sports Academy, now the U.S. Sports University, having retired in 2023 after 47 years of service to the institution. I'm just trying to think. There he goes, offering degrees. That's that. Besides serving as an employee of the Academy for decades, he's also an alumnus, having received his Master of Sports Science degree and Sports Management, Director of Education degree in Sports Management, and has received a Distinguished Service Award in 2015. He was the Alumnus of the Year in 1994. But as we heard in the interview, he's worked in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, I think.
Served in the military as well.
Yeah, he was a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne.
The 101, like one of the most famous regiments in the American military.
Yeah, I mean, an amazing man. And I feel so privileged we managed to have him on the show and that he agreed to come on the show. But I think the interesting thing, though, John, as we've been saying for over 20 years... How do you work it out? We reckon they just pluck the numbers from the air, and it would appear that that is the case.
Who would have thunk it? Who would have thunk? I mean, one of the things that I find interesting is that we're never given any metrics for how this has worked out. Never. It's just, yep, this is what we did, and no one questions it. I think the problem is that sports these days... They see these events as an opportunity to make money. It's all about making money, and they don't see it as a community event. Let's do something for the community. It's let's do something for the economy, and it does bugger all for the economy.
Well, the one that always stands out, and I know I've mentioned this before, when Manchester United went to New South Wales, the New South Wales said, I think, that it was going to generate, and I know I've got the figure wrong, but let's say hypothetically, they said, this will generate $40 million for the New South Wales economy. The game was played on the Saturday night. Monday morning, the government said, we generated $40 million. How did they know in 48 hours? How can you do the totting up with your calculator in less than 48 hours? So it just shows that, you know, these numbers are made up. And I think you've seen here that obviously somebody leaked the... Tourism WA events figures and what they spent on their budget. Now, it was interesting to read in that report that they were claiming that for every dollar They invested in sporting events or tourism-related events. They gained $2.80 for every dollar.
Is that the government got $2.80?
Well, the state, they were saying.
So the government spends a dollar and then
it generates $2.80
within the state. That's an interesting way to put it.
But it's very interesting that that has obviously been leaked, and now we've seen the CEO has been fired and the Minister for Tourism has been moved to another portfolio. But yeah, look, I've worried about it. I think it was very interesting as well when TJ was talking about the issues with Stadia now in America and how those have become just a way to make money. And I think, as he said, one of his friends said, you know, I'm going to a stadium built by billionaires to watch millionaires play.
Yeah, and it's not going to be too long before it'll be a stadium built by billionaires to watch billionaires play.
Yeah. And I mean, you know me with Optus Stadium here, that the taxpayer built, and it's a fantastic stadium. Don't get me wrong. It's great for oval sports. It's not good for rectangular sports.
No.
And I was pleased to see somebody actually came out and said that in the government this week, that it was not a good place to watch the sport. But here we were, as taxpayers, we build the damn thing. Then we find the government pays money to get events there, which is our money as taxpayers. And then they expect us to pay to go to the game. So as a taxpayer, we're paying three times to watch something.
Yeah. And let's face it, what are you watching? Like, we've got some football, soccer games coming up. And they're friendlies.
Yeah, preseason games.
You know, it'd be different if it was round 15 of Sierra A and these two teams are coming out here. There'd be something in the game, but it's not. It's an advanced training session. Oh, come on, please.
Yeah, and games that don't mean anything, really.
Yeah, and do you really see the best players out there?
Well, you're not going to see some of the World Cup ones, I don't think, will be playing, or if they do, it'll be limited. Oh, sorry, Italy weren't at the World Cup, were they?
See ya. We'll be back next week.